Hello and welcome to another Emmy edition of the Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host Clarence Moy, and today I'm joined by Ben Platt, the star of Netflix comedy series The Politician. Now in its second season, The Politician stars Ben as Peyton Hobart, the self-proclaimed future president of the United States. Ben, welcome to the Water Cooler.
Thank you. How's it going?
It's good. How are you in all of this craziness and madness ongoing?
I'm holding up. I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of comforts that a lot of people don't have in terms of space to be and food to eat during all this. So I just appreciating that and the extra time with the family and going stir crazy like everyone else.
Yeah, same. I do want to stop and just thank you for joining me here today. I know it's uncomfortable to talk about these things when you're looking at, you know, race riots and all of the COVID crises that are happening, but thank you for taking the time and just wanted to acknowledge that.
Of course, I think, you know, particularly with all that's happening in terms of this discovery of white privilege and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I think, you know, as long as you're taking the right action and involving yourself and amplifying the right voices, and, you know, we have to get to a stage in which we can be doing all of that work and making that part of a really feasible existence. And, you know, there won't always be this really opportune moment where we're all available to be fully, you know, engaged because of this pandemic. So I think training ourselves to, you know, do the things we need to do in our own lives and still be constantly active and find ways to fuse that into a normal routine, I think is going to be really important for the movement moving forward. So happy.
Very well put. So let's get started. The Politician obviously marks the first time, I think, that you've worked with Ryan Murphy on a broad scale. How was it working with Ryan?
I mean, pretty wonderful. He's, you know, I was always a fan of his growing up, particularly as a queer teenager watching Glee in high school. And the stories that he chose to tell and the sort of elegance and the satire and the sort of biting skewering of all these, you know, these people. I loved the tone of it. And I always imagined that hoped that I would get to be involved in that universe in some way. So to do it in a piece like The Politician, where I am getting to play a character that has all of this kind of breadth and gets to show all these different kind of tools that I have, and also get to executive produce alongside Ryan and have some sort of creative ownership alongside him, is sort of the nth degree of what I was hoping from an experience with him. And he's just a really clear vision, and he knows how to execute that vision on all levels. And that's why he is able to be so prolific, I think, is that he knows how to actualize all of those things.
Yeah, I read a tweet, or maybe I think it was a tweet or an Instagram post the other day, where he was saying, I think it was tongue in cheek, but he would like to revisit Glee with you and a couple of other people. It's crazy to think about, you know, you were watching that and then all of a sudden now he's talking about, you know, working with you again.
Yes, wild pandemic musings from Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. So talking specifically about Peyton, you know, Peyton is a bit of a cipher. You know, so many times during the series, season one and in season two, he talks about he doesn't know himself. He needs to find himself. When you sat down and looked at the script, how did you decide how to play a character that is essentially a cipher?
I think of him a lot as like an actor, like as a master of disguise kind of a guy who is like wildly, like, I think I've been asked a lot about like what politicians did you base him on, and who is he, you know, is he Pete Buttigieg? Is he JFK? Is he, and certainly in terms of the cadence and in terms of the, you know, the little signals that someone is a politician, I certainly have taken from different, you know, speeches and things like that. But in terms of who he is as a human being, my way in, I always felt, was going to be that he performs. You know, he knows how to be perceived the way he wants to be perceived. And whether that's, you know, as a sympathetic person or as a confident person or as a powerful or as, you know, in the most intelligent in the room, even if he isn't the most intelligent in the room. And so that getting to play with, you know, how much at any given moment in any given scene and in any given relationship, how much is he posturing and how much is he putting on for his own benefit and how much is what he really is. And in terms of what I believe he really is, I think he's very unsure of that. And he's grappling with the fact that he's still able to accomplish a lot of the things he wants to without having to really make that definitive decision of who he is. And I think being afraid of whether that is going to bite him in the ass later on is kind of the excitement of playing him, is, you know, this eternal question, particularly in the world of politics, of like, if all of this, you know, good and benevolent leadership is from a place of self promoting and just wanting to forward your own career and your own power and your own, you know, realizing your own dreams, does it really matter that that is the intention behind it if what's being accomplished is for the greater good? I think he just is somebody who really is striving to be significant and to mean something, and particularly since he's been adopted by Gwyneth and Bob Balaban into this like very privileged, heightened world. And he feels, I think, innately that he doesn't necessarily belong in it. And so he is kind of overcompensating in the sense that he wants to always take up space and prove himself to be powerful.
Mm-hmm. So as you look back over season one, what would you say was your most challenging scene to film or to break down in your head and figure out how you were going to play it?
It's a great question. I think there were two. I think that the first is probably the more obvious just in terms of the outward emotion. And it's at the end of the pilot. There's a scene with Jessica Lange and Zoe Deutsch where Peyton goes to Infinity and Dusty's house and has to a certain extent, put on a performance for them where he shares his authentic self in order to gain Infinity's trust. He wants her to believe that she's seeing the real him. And so he goes and gives a rather tearful monologue and has a really emotional outburst about how he sees himself as a fraud and how he loved River very much, his friend who has just taken his own life. And I think that the difficult part of that scene, apart from just sort of arriving to an emotional place in any scene, is obviously always a difficult thing and just making sure that that feels authentic. But I think juggling the difference between, you know, what parts of Peyton is he actually willing to show in this moment and what parts are really authentic that he really does want to share, and what is he doing just to forward his relationship with Infinity and just to gain trust and just to appear sympathetic. And I think that it was difficult to not make a firm decision, but also important not to make a firm decision, because it's obviously in a pilot we're setting up this greater question that hopefully the character has to answer over the course of the series. And so I didn't want the sort of button of that first episode to be, oh, he really is just this wonderful, sweet person, and he does all have all this emotion, and it's all just kind of been posturing, and underneath he's crumbling and he's vulnerable, and that's who he is. Mm-hmm. Certainly there are aspects of that, but it had to be tied in with, he knows how to cry, he knows how to bring those things out when he needs them. And that's not to say that they aren't rooted in real emotion or that they aren't rooted in an authentic experience, but he is manipulating those emotions and bringing them out at a particular time. So that was a really exciting and challenging thing. And then the other would just be another scene that was also happened to be with Zoe Deutsch, where Peyton is letting her know that she is a victim of Munchausen by proxy. He's essentially letting her know that her grandmother's been poisoning her, and he's the one who breaks that news to her. And it comes at a point where he believes she's out of the race and she's become a liability and she's no longer helpful to him. So in a certain, light, it's an entirely, you know, there's no selflessness required because it doesn't affect him anymore. So he might as well just tell her and get that out of the way, because now it won't really affect him. But there's also a part of him that as a human being feels for this girl and wants her to know that something horrible is happening to her. So it was a similar, fun, kind of juicy challenge to play both sides of that and make sure you're seeing that Peyton is not a monster. He does want to tell this girl that she's in danger, but also only at a time when it's now convenient for him to also say that to her. So playing this kind of dichotomous, not so easily likable, morally ambiguous guy, those scenes are probably the most challenging, but also the ones that make it feel like the biggest meal.
You talk about Jessica, you're facing off against Jessica Lange in season one. You have Judith Light and Bette Midler in season two. What is it like as a younger actor to then all of a sudden now have all of these powerhouse scenes with these enormous iconic actresses?
Well, firstly, as a queer man, it's like a dream come true. But also just as to have all these incredible dames just like acting their faces off in front of me. But I think, you know, as an actor, it makes you rise to the occasion. You know, it forces you to be better than you think you can be, because you're sharing the screen with people who are the top of their game, the absolute top of their game, whether it's, you know, Jessica and her like unbelievable, like she won't even really consider herself a comedian, and yet the way in which she plays everything with such a reality and such she's so dead serious about everything that she says as Dusty, that is so unbelievably hilarious. And so to not, on a superficial level, to not like ruin her takes by just laughing and enjoying her performance, and which I did do many times, and then to also try to rise to that occasion and be playing it just as real and just as funny as she is, it was a huge fire under my butt and a huge challenge that it was a very welcome challenge. And then this season now we have Judith Light, who is the most warm and wonderful human being I think I've ever met, and Bette Midler, who is an absolute titan, who I've watched all growing up give all sorts of iconic comedic performances in, you know, Hocus Pocus and Gypsy and Big Business and everything, and to watch her give a fully realized comic performance that's just like all of those, with nothing missing, in the thing that you're also in, it's like a bit of a heady experience, and also was another moment to be like, Ben, you really need to rise to this occasion and be worthy of sharing the screen with, you know, this is a legendary person who knows the ins and outs of what she's doing, and you're still learning and you're still growing, but you have got to really rise to the occasion. So I have a lot of the growth that came from this experience. A lot of that I have Bette and Judith and Gwyneth and Jessica to really thank for.
Awesome. I just revisited Big Business on Disney Plus not too long ago. I hadn't seen it since I was younger. And
it's a good quarantine watch.
Yeah, it is. It is a good quarantine watch. So when you look at The Politician, you know, especially in season one with the voter episode, the standalone sort of the bottle episode. Yes. And then in season two, you know, it touches on a lot of heady political topics. You know, there's a lot of commentary about politics and voting and young voters. Ultimately, what do you think the series is saying about politics in general?
Sure. You know, I think that the series does a really good job, particularly the second season, of offering glimpses of things that are really relevant to us and that we want to comment on, but only as a backdrop to this kind of sharp and bizarre and kooky world, slightly fantastical world that we're presenting. And I think when you present, particularly to young people, when you present these ideas to them in that kind of a setting, I think it can be a little more effective than when it's kind of an outright sort of lecture, or if it's really the subject matter in and of itself. Particularly the message that I think is probably the most relevant to this moment that exists in the show, which is this activation of young voters and the involvement of young people in sort of needing to use their voices and showing that is not only necessary for them, but can also actually affect change and can make the difference. And again, it's obviously shown in a very ridiculous kind of setting in terms of like Peyton showering outdoors in this, like, you know, demonstration in Flatiron, and, you know, this very particular wild thruple storyline. All of this stuff is kind of, it's sort of like subliminal underneath all of that, that like it is important for young people to be listening and paying attention and making their voices heard. And hopefully that's kind of a subconscious takeaway for the young people that are watching, just to enjoy kind of the comedy and the satire of it all. And that without really sort of somewhat unbeknownst to them, hopefully that they'll also internalize this idea that like they're just as involved in the discourse as all of these older people are.
Absolutely. So looking at season two, for those who haven't caught up to it yet, how does Peyton grow from season one into season two?
Totally. So I view Peyton in the first season as sort of like having all of his gates open emotionally, in terms of like, you know, obviously the hubris and confidence and arrogance and desire for power is what's leading him. But he gets tripped up in so many ways by all of these different emotions that he allows to flow freely in and out, in terms of like jealousy and passion and anger and selfishness and all these things. And he's so raw because he's so young in that first season. Mm-hmm. So for me, the second season was about maintaining kind of the innate conflicts of all of those things, but he's allowing him to get a little better at shielding himself from that and thriving even in the midst of that. So I don't think you get to see quite as much of his hand, if that makes sense. I think he keeps his cards a little closer to the chest now that he's learning what it really takes to be a politician. And while he still has these flights of rage and ridiculous passion and all that, and gets caught up in all that, he is able to stay a little bit more level-headed. Certainly, I think his arrogance and his desire to be the top and be the most powerful and the most intelligent in the room is ever present. But I think he's learning that the way to accomplish that is to really put that behind something intentional and benevolent and affect some actual greater good and greater change in order to accomplish that, which obviously all comes back to the question that's my favorite that the show poses, which is if the ends are the same and we're accomplishing that fantastic change, does it really matter that the person contributing to that and putting that into effect is only doing so to forward his own, you know, ego, essentially. So it's fun to watch him morph in that way. And then I don't want to give too much away, but in the end, he, I think, grows to an even greater extent and begins to learn that he can find some of that power and empowerment and ego filling just from the work itself and from the actual job of being a politician and affecting the change, rather than the campaign aspect and the beating someone out aspect and the posturing aspect. He starts to really learn that like he can feed his hubris and his arrogance with just the positive change and the actual work, which I hope is something that a lot of politicians also feel, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. So in just a few words, you know, put yourself in the future in the politician, in the world of the politician. Should Peyton, you know, ascend to the office of the president of the United States, what kind of president would he be?
It's tough because there's so much that can change. I mean, I think if he continues on the path he's on now and continues surrounding himself with the people that he is surrounding himself with, like Sky played by Ronnie Jones and James played by Keel Germain and with Judith Light and, you know, Bette Midler and with Hadassah and Didi and the people that are checking him in the way that they are, and Alice, his wife, who he now kind of has, sorry to spoil for anyone who hasn't seen, but he now has a much healthier relationship with and a child with, you know, I think hopefully he can start leaning even more into that last sentiment that I was talking about, which is this idea that they don't have to be at war with each other, this desire for power and ego and this desire to actually affect change, that they can feed one another. Mm-hmm. And so if he did by some crazy Ryan Murphy universe way get to be the president, I think, you know, I think his ego would be in a place that it has never been before and would need to certainly be checked in a way that it hasn't been before. But I also think he'd be in a position to really, he'd have a big fire under his butt to really make significant change that he can be remembered for. And he'd have the people around him to ensure that that change that's going to go on his record is actually positive change and necessary change. So I think there's a world in which he could be a great president, especially if he had someone like Judith Light with him, or, you know, Hadassah with him, or, you know, one of these fantastic women with him.
Right. All right. So two more questions for you. First, I know Netflix just dropped earlier in May dropped Live from Radio City Music Hall. Tell me about that experience, walking on that stage, filming that concert. I mean, it must have been a pinch me moment for sure.
Yeah, it was inordinately, I mean, it was very, very special. It was a kind of a culmination of a lot of things. It was the first, you know, this past couple of years is the first time that I've written my own material and my own music and shared my own perspective and my own point of view and performed purely as myself without anyone else's character imposed on me or anyone else's writing or story imposed on me, which has been a scary thing and a vulnerable thing, obviously, to go out there without any kind of safety net of a structure. And I think I grew a lot into that and found how deeply I love that experience and sharing that part of myself with people. And so the culmination of that, even separate from the filming of it for Netflix, was that show at Radio City, in terms of, you know, New York is where I call home, and that is such an iconic venue that holds a lot of, you know, power and respect. And so to play there at all felt very nerve-wracking and exciting and like a kind of an arrival. And then to have it immortalized in this way where people that weren't even in the room with me get to experience this kind of authentic and as open as possible version of who I am on this amazing night that I hope to remember always. It was a beautiful amalgam of things, because it's this great home video that I now have forever to remember that experience for myself, but it also is a way to reach so many more people than could ever have been there. And especially now, given the pandemic, which is something we could never have anticipated, there was something kind of weird divine intervention about it where I really wanted to focus so much in the making of the special on making it feel that you were really present and really preserving the live quality and the live feeling of it, the sweat and the imperfections and the sound. And I wanted it to really feel that you were in the room. And people now, in a way that I could never have expected, are really craving that experience, given the fact that we can't really have any live music experiences right now and go see any performing live. So to give people that kind of an escape for an hour and a half where you do feel immersed in a group of sweating and singing is, I think, a special thing. And I just feel lucky that it can provide that little bit of a respite for people now, hopefully.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a fantastic concert. So congratulations for that. Last thing, I would be remiss as a father if I didn't say that my daughter is a huge fan of yours and has been since Pitch Perfect. And then seeing Dear Evan Hansen, and then hearing the music, of course, and listening to the music almost daily, as she does, and I do too. Huge fans. So she wanted to say hello. And then, you know, there's been some news lately about the potential film version, or the upcoming film version, where potentially Caitlin Dever may join you in whenever it starts to film, whenever the, you know, it's safe to film again.
Right.
How do you think the play will change from stage to film?
That's a great question. You know, it all remains to be seen. I think that we're interested in preserving all the things that are beautiful about the story, but also I think that the best film adaptations, particularly when it comes to a musical, are the ones that are not overly precious about the material and that are willing to morph the narrative and the story to something that's going to be equally satisfying and uncompromised on film. And I think there's going to need to be a little bit more of a reckoning with what Evan has done in the film version, hopefully, and a little bit more of a comeuppance for Evan, and hopefully, you know, he'll have an opportunity that he doesn't have in the show, just given the length of what a live musical is and the setting of what a live musical is, to really change based on the experience. And also, I think that the world of it is just going to be informed by the fact that even compared to 2017, we live in a pretty different world in terms of technology and discourse and race and privilege and all these things. So we would be remiss not to try to make sure that the movie would reflect the ways in which society's changed. But, you know, I think it will ultimately just rely on telling Evan's particular story as filmically as we can, if we are so lucky as to make it. So here's hoping that that's possible.
Looking forward to it again, to be have you reduce me to a sobbing mess more than once. I'm not ashamed to admit. All right, well, I think that's everything I have for you today, Ben. Thank you so much for joining me here at the Water Cooler. Thank you for the performance on both The Politician and on live from Radio City Music Hall. It's a really tremendous year for you, so thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.